This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of PlantYourself.com, the Big Change Program, and WellStart Health. This podcast is part of my mission to help you live an incredible and inspirational life. I'm going to be real brief with the introduction because today's interview is the longest I've ever done. It's almost 2 hours, just the conversation, and it's with D. Anthony Evans. I met him at the Wellness Forum Health Conference this past November, and he just blew everyone away with his inspirational story and the utter positivity and focus and, I don't know, just a spirit that I guess has been honed. It's available to each of us, I suppose, I hope, but it's been honed by D. Anthony's life of challenges and his mindset that has allowed him to overcome them. He found out around the age of 6 that he had this rare disorder called neurofibromatosis, it's hard for me to say, that caused these painful tumors to emerge at random all over his body. And he was told from pretty much as young as he could understand that it generally leads to this highly aggressive form of cancer, MPNST, malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumors, a little bit easier for me to say. So he and his mom were just sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop, waiting for this cancer to strike. When? Where? And these tumors would grow all over his body. There's photos of him on the internet with basically looks like a loaf of bread on his skull, on top of his head. And just, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these tumors would pop up. He said each one felt like multiple bee stings all the time. He rejected the cocktail of painkillers that were generally prescribed for people with this disorder because it just made him feel not alive. And so he turned to sports, he turned to academic achievement, and then his life fell apart in so many ways. And rather than rehash it here, just let me say, you will not be sorry you've invested the 2 hours to listen to the whole story. One quick item of business before we get there, and that is the next cohort of WellStart Health / Big Change Program begins this coming Monday, May 21st. We're already sending out information to participants, so you can't delay much longer. We're closing it out on Thursday. Today's Tuesday. If you're interested, go to wellstarthealth.com/program, where you can apply, and we will try to expedite it if you're a fit. All right, let's get to it. Without further ado, D. Anthony Evans, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It is an absolute pleasure to be here. How are you, Howard?
I'm doing great. I'm 50% more energetic now than I was before I saw your beaming face.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And likewise, you as well.
All right. So we met a few months ago at the Wellness Forum Health Conference, and everybody was blown away by your talk, by your story, by your energy.
Yes, sir.
I among them. And then the following morning, I rewarded myself by going to the gym at an ungodly hour, and you were there and helped me do my first unassisted pull-up.
Yes, sir. Yes, and you did an amazing job. I just must add that in there.
Yeah, thanks. So I don't want to, you know, mess that up by doing another one. I figured I had taken action. No, just kidding. Just kidding.
I know you've been working at it.
But, you know, your calling card is just inspiration, just oozing out of every pore. Everyone who comes across you is inspired to make themselves better in some dimension.
Thank you.
And so I'm so excited to be privileged to share your story with my listeners. So why don't we get into it? That's like,
okay.
Give us the story.
So, you know, basically, you know, I was born with a rare neurological disorder called neurofibromatosis. It's mostly referred to as NF1 or NF2. And with NF, it basically causes tumors to spontaneously form on your nerves anywhere in your body without notice. And as a child, if it's active in your body, your doctor usually, you know, lets you know that you will be fighting cancer the second half of your life. They just don't know when. So every NF patient and their parents is walking around after they've been diagnosed every day after that, wondering, when is my turn to fight cancer? And it's a very, it messes with you mentally, it messes with you physically, emotionally. I have them over 84% of my body, and I would equate the pain, because they're on my peripheral nerves, to that of a multiple bee stings, all at the same time, everywhere, perpetually, sometimes greater than others. I happen to have hypersensitive tumors. Some people's tumors don't affect them. Mine let me know they're there regularly. So as a child, instead of taking the cocktail, Norco, Percocet, Oxycontin, Remeron, Celexa, and Neurontin is just a few that a typical NF patient administers to themselves three times a day and doesn't really have a quality of life. And after that first dose of that and just not being able to move, like my mind is saying walk and I can't get up because I'm in such a state from the drugs, I didn't want any part of the chemical part of what I was going through, and just got heavily engulfed in sports. And the sports didn't take away the pain, but it kind of distracted me from the pain.
So this was
diagnosed at 6. Really knew what it was at about 8. Became self-conscious about it about 8.5. I had them internally, but I didn't understand what that pain or discomfort was as a child. I only knew what I saw. And what I saw was a tumor on my wrist that basically looked like a nipple, and one on my left knee. And the one on my knee, being that I was a long jumper, I was in track, and a basketball player, it would, from time to time, give me a lot of discomfort. And the University of Chicago in 1993 was doing a study where, in exchange for my likeness, they would do the actual surgery, because our tumors have been coded as pre-existing cosmetic lesions, as opposed to the conduit for MPNST, which is a rare sarcoma that's associated with our disease, the cancer they're talking about. So my mother was excited about this actual health care that we're going to receive in form of surgery, and signed me up. But let me back up. Before that, my mother was diagnosed with AIDS and HIV. And I lost her the second week of junior year, but I continued to fight on because of her. And my whole life and my inspiration is pulled from her. The doctor basically was not honest with me. And when he was sharing about the effects of the surgery, he kind of minimized the severity. And at 16, I didn't understand that neuro, you know, meant nerve, and you need your nerves to run wind sprints for 3 or 4 hours. In Evanston, where I'm from, you must dress August 1st, or you have to forfeit your spot on the team. And the doctor assured me that, you know, it was subcutaneous, it was above the skin, and you'll be as good as new August 1st. Make a long story short, I wasn't who I needed to be August 1st. I had to forfeit my spot on the team. And 30 days after that, I lost my mother to AIDS and HIV the second week of junior year. So I basically lost to two things I was waking up in the morning for. Like, my mother had me in a program called STAY, Step Towards Academic Excellency. It was an Ivy League program for minorities that were bright. And they had kind of recruited me in seventh and eighth grade. And all I had to do was graduate and keep my grades up, and I would secure a scholarship in basically any school I wanted to go to. So this was my mission, and really what my mother programmed in me to get us out of our impoverished situation. In reflection, that's how I see it. So I couldn't like hang out after school. I had to be home before the street lights came on. My whole life, my ears still aren't pierced. My whole life was dedicated to this woman and basketball and making her smile and just trying to, I just saw her cry too many nights, and we just come from nothing. And I was on this mission to do something for my mother. And when she died, it was like as a child, you have structure, you know right from wrong. Even if you don't want to hear it, you know you have somebody that's holding you accountable. And when she died, I got mad at her. I got mad at God. I was just angry because I didn't understand how I did everything I was asked to do. Everything I was asked to do. And then I'm left here by myself, not knowing what to do or who to trust or who to listen to. The woman I trusted told me she was sick 6 months before she passed. And it wasn't because she was being dishonest. She thought it was too much for me and felt that I needed to focus on education. And I agree with her to a certain extent, but it had the opposite effect. Like, I gave up on life. The day she died, like, the pain was so intense that I didn't want to move forward. So that turned into a destructive downward spiral.
So it sounds like your reality looked like two completely different things. Just as I'm listening to it, it sounds so confusing that on the one hand, you've got this potentially deadly disease that's going to lead to cancer. On the other hand, it's a cosmetic thing that they can take care of easily. On the one hand, your mother is this vibrant driving force in your life. And then the next day you find out that she's extremely vulnerable and frail.
Yes, it's she told me when Magic came out, I'll never forget. It was six o'clock news and she was crying in the living room. And so much that I heard her from my bedroom. And I walked out there, what are you crying about, Mom? And Magic is on TV, like professing to the world that he has AIDS. And she said, I have it too. And I remember her not letting me drink out of her pop cans or not letting me eat off with her silverware. I didn't put two and two together. I thought she was stingy and selfish, to be honest with you. She would not let me eat after her. And I thought it was the weirdest thing for several years. But that night, I was like, wow. And then pieces just started materializing in my mind. It was a bunch of emotions. It was a bunch of things going on. I had positive and negative and positive and negative. And I folded. I folded as a 16-year-old AIDS orphan. I had a father, but he chose substance abuse over asking me, did I have anywhere to live? He came to our funeral and, you know, if I came to my son's mother's funeral and I knew she was the primary caregiver, I'd ask, you know, you have somewhere to stay? Who are you going to live with? And he told me it was good to see me, and he left. And I'm cool with that. But what I'm getting at is that I was alone. I had my grandmother. I had aunts. But I was angry, and they were trying to parent me. And my parent just died. And so I pushed them away. Was homeless temporarily, got recruited by a street gang, and began to abuse, use, and sell drugs just to survive. And not necessarily because nobody loved me or I didn't have anywhere to go. I mean, my godfather was a reverend of our church. Like, I didn't want to be preached to either in this time. Like, I just wanted to be left alone.
So the street gang.
Yes.
Did you feel like they understood you in a different way than your aunts and grandmother and godfather?
I felt like they weren't asking me, how are you doing? Like, my grandmother, my godfather, and my aunts, they wanted me to grieve. I wanted to ignore it and pretend like it never happened, because it was that much of a hot button issue in my spirit. Like, the thought of it, I would just bust into tears and disintegrate. And I didn't want any parts of that. I had my pride and ego at 16. I was pride filled too. I'm a man now, and men don't cry. I didn't have a man to show me how to be a man ever. My mother couldn't show me how to be a man. I had to figure that out. And what I did know about men is that you're not supposed to cry. That's what I thought. That's what you see on TV. That's who raised me, TV. And so I compartmentalized it. And all they wanted to do was talk about my mother not being here and what they could do for me. And I just wanted silence on that. The street gang didn't care about that. They really didn't care. And in reflection, that's messed up. In the moment, though, I'm with people who are saying they care for me, and they're not talking about my mother. And I was safe. Mm-hmm. And I was vulnerable. It was a time where I needed somebody, and they were there.
It sounds like they probably were happy about your skill set.
Very happy about my skill set, and happy that I had the mind that I had, because they didn't necessarily want me to be a gangbanger. They wanted me for financial reasons. They wanted me for my mind. And what happened is, engulfed in the gang, but still the grief and things were still there. And they were really, my teenage years were dealing with this grief turbulence that I've been ignoring. And what I would do is, on all of the trigger dates, which is her death date, September 13th, I'd get submerged in drugs and alcohol and disappear and be inebriated for 3 or 4 days just to get through those 3 or 4 days surrounding her death anniversary. And then I'd be okay from September 13th to December 21st, which is her birthday, where I was born on her birthday. So that rekindles up. You can't make this stuff up. I was celebrating my birthday for 16 years with someone that passed. And every time that date would come around, it's hard to celebrate and be happy when the person you shared it with is not here. It's mm-hmm. extremely difficult. And I would engage in the same behavior, the same thing, drugs and alcohol, try to numb myself for 3 to 4 days just to get through it. And then I'd be good until I got to June, Mother's Day, or July, June or July, whichever Mother's Day is in. And I fall apart again. And if you look at that, they're spaced out just enough where I get like 3 or 4 months of peace and serenity, and then I fall apart. They're perfectly triangulated in a triangle where I could not really get in front of the year. When I get my stuff together, fall apart. Get it together again, fall apart. Get it together. And I was on, this wasn't a spiral. This is what I call the Bermuda Triangle, because it was just a triangle of death. So much so that in my 7th year of that type of therapy, I woke up strapped to a board in Alexian Brothers Behavioral Health Center. I had tried to take my life, and I took everything in the medicine cabinet. I don't really remember the act. I don't even remember before that. I just remember the charcoal taste in my mouth for them making me vomit the pills up. And I remember, you know, being very agitated that I couldn't move my arms. And as bad as this sounds, this is really what changed my life for the for the better, because there was a doctor in there. And these type of doctors, they see, you know, substance abuse individuals and see this story on its surface so much. I mean, those facilities are usually like a revolving door. And they usually, you get sober and then they sign you out. This particular doctor, you know, and I know it's because I came in there combative, but he said, "Mr. Evans, I want you to, you know, participate in group." And I'm telling him, "I'm fine. I don't know what happened, but I know what you guys said happened. I'm okay. I'm fine. I just want to go home. And could you please let me out of the restraints?" I said it nicely the first time. He said, "Mr. Evans, you're not really in a position to go home. I really want you to give group a shot." And I said a couple expletives at him, because now I'm getting frustrated because they won't. I'm knowing now that they're not going to let me off of this board that's restrained. And my third expletive, he said, "Look, I'm going to make it very clear and very simple for you. You're going to participate in group, or you're basically going to be here indefinitely." And I say that because the two prerequisites that I need to take power of attorney over you is that you came in here combative, trying to harm my staff, so you're a harm to others, and you tried to kill yourself. And those are the two things that I need, you know, to call my judge friend to take custody of you, and you will be here indefinitely. That really riled me up. Instead of that scaring me, I said some more expletives, and he told them to take him to his room. They took me to my room, and I wasn't able to leave. He wasn't lying. It was a locked floor, fifth floor, Alexian Brothers, Hoffman Estates in Illinois, and I wasn't able to leave. And on the third week of my rebellion, he made it interesting. He transferred me to the side of the psychiatric ward that the real mentally challenged individuals were, that were talking to napkin holders. They're unresponsive to anything, and they're just zombies. I'm on the zombie side. Before, I was with the manic depressives, the dope fiends, and the at-risk teenagers. And now I'm over there in full-blown One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest heaven. And it was on that side. I didn't last more than maybe an hour. And I was having my nurse page that paged my doctor. And he came and talked. He said, "You ready?" I said, "I'm ready." And he broke me at 3 weeks. And we went back on the other side. And I just, you know, got introduced to some amazing clinicians and social workers that, you know, they were determined to show me that life doesn't have to be like this. And the reason you're so angry and the reason you don't want to be here is because you've never dealt with your mother leaving. And that's completely normal. And I learned some techniques. They taught me how to burn my feelings on paper. I got the reboot, though, in that hospitalization. Go ahead. I think I cut you off.
Yeah, well, I'm curious about that period between, you know, when your mother died and when you were brought into the locked ward. At that point, were you still undergoing all this medical care for your tumors? Were they still growing? Or
No. That's when my pride and ego was in full effect, in the sense that I said that I would never talk to my doctor again. The one person that can save my life, I made a pact with myself that I will never talk to him, because he lied to me about the severity of my operation. And had he been a little more forthcoming with the risk and that I was going to lose basketball, I wouldn't have done it. Because in my 16-year-old mind, I had told myself that had I still been able to compete, it would have distracted me, and I'd have been able to lean on my team, and I'd have had my team. You know, I'd have lost my mom, but I would have still had basketball. I didn't have to have that surgery. the rush to have the surgery is because we hadn't been covered my whole life, the 16 years. And my mom saw the study. So that's what the rush to surgery was, that somebody finally wants to do an operation on you after I've been asking your entire life. So I was just angry.
So, but during this time, were the tumors still growing?
Yeah, they were still doing what they do, and I'm ignoring them like a dumb man.
And they're hurting all the time.
They're hurting all the time. I was a marijuana smoker as well, cannabis smoker. And in retrospect, I know that helped, but that's not even why I was smoking before. But with everything I know now, it absolutely all makes sense, because I was heavily, heavily cannabis induced in that time. And I know now that cannabis does help my tumors receptors with pain. Like, that's a proven fact. And I didn't know that then, though. And this is the only thing that I can equate as the reason why I was able to not, I didn't go see him for 18 years, Howard, 18. How stupid am I? 18 years. Because I was upset that I felt he lied to me. So yeah, the tumors were still growing, but I was still pretending that it was the pink elephant in the room. It was the dumbest thing I've ever done, to be completely honest with you, in retrospect. I was stupid.
So during that time, did you stay with the gang the whole time, or did you have sort of career aspirations? Did you end up going back to school or thinking about future?
No, even with the gang. So I still graduated high school on the dean's list. I made up 2 years of work at my house with the pregnancy tutors. Like, with the girls that get pregnant, they send the tutor home with you and you do your work at home. My dean, because I was that student, I had worked this hard with my mom, and the whole school was around this program for gifted minorities. So they came to me like, you're going to throw all this away? You worked since seventh grade for this, D. I passed, but it wasn't with the high marks. Like, the scholarship stuff was out, but I passed and made up 2.5 years worth of work my senior year, in like 7 months, and made the dean's list, walked the stage at graduation and everything after dropping out the second week of junior year. After that, went to, even when I was recruited, I did a year and a half, 2 years at Columbia. I tried. I just couldn't stay focused.
Columbia University in New York?
No, Columbia Music and University and Arts and Music University in Chicago.
Okay.
Because I have a background in music as well. And you didn't know that?
No.
Yeah, I'm a poet. I paint pictures with words, Howard. You wanna hear something?
Sure.
All right. And it's fitting in the sense that this is a coping mechanism that I used when my mother died. It's painful, but bear with me. Tears fill up my eyes when I sit and reminisce. I miss my mother's hugs and I miss my mother's kiss. I often find myself cuddled up with her pictures. My peers don't understand, because my peers don't really miss her. Why'd you have to leave me, mommy? Why'd you have to go? Why am I left alone? Mommy, why before I'm grown? I feel like popping pills or getting a gun and ending this. Or maybe ending it all like Biggie Smalls and slitting my wrist. See, I don't give a care, and I'm often asking why. Why'd you have to leave me? Mommy, why'd you have to die? That's why I blaze my reefer. Cause there's no more Mother's Day for me, bruh. She died, gone, left me on this planet, feeling weaker, only 16, my world crushed. Imagine seeing a machine pump life into your mom's lungs, her time's done. Counted the drops of IV flow to her arm, yelling, why me? It busted my heart, it broke inside me, so I locked myself up in my crib. Revolver, one bullet, cock squeezed and spin. Three clicks, I didn't win. I'm still here. Felt that my peers didn't grasp the depth of my speech. Only the ones with family resting in peace ingested my grief. While it is how I thought daily. Is God shady? Does he hate me? How'd he let Cherie leave a baby? And that's kind of what I learned when they, you know, when I was hospitalized. It's like, write it down, D, write it down. And that's a song that I was never able to finish. But when those trigger dates would come, you know, post my hospitalization, this I sit here and recite this and just cry and just deal with it and try to be still in the storm, not even knowing that's what I was doing.
Wow.
But yeah, the Columbia, I'm heavily into music. It's my thing. And that turned into promoting concerts and young artists promotion at clubs and things like that. And started a company called Global 360, where we brokered time for air. We brokered airtime for Clear Channel and CBS, giving young businesses and small businesses an opportunity to be on cable through geo-targeting. I have found my niche. One of my mentors, Morris Butch Stewart, had taught me how to make jingles at like 12 through this program at my junior high. So I was pretty crafty at that. And I just took what he taught me, coupled with what I already knew, and linked up with the right business partners. And we were able to put people on cable television that, you know, an account exec would quote you for the nation instead of the people that would patronize your business. And there's a huge market for that. Uh-huh. They don't really show you how to market to who's going to patronize you. They show you how to buy marketing for the whole world when the whole world is not coming to your small town to get an oil change. And I found a niche in that market. But that's what I was doing.
Gotcha. So, I mean, it looks like, you know, like this is some weird science fiction movie where you split in two.
Yes.
Right? I mean, I'm just seeing like that beautiful song poem you just recited was both. I heard so much about I'm a victim, and yet the way you used it was to reclaim your agency. It's like and this kid who's, you know, self-destructing massively. And at the same time as a person who's like a really sharp, go-getting entrepreneur. Like,
yes.
I feel like I'm having interviews with two completely different interviews with two completely different people.
You are, and that was supposed to be my secret. No, but yeah. It's an interesting dichotomy my whole life. And that's why I can speak in Cook County Jail and in Congress and have done both. Because the story just resonates with so many people. There's really not a crowd of people that if you read my story from front to back, couldn't point at a piece like, yeah, I relate to that. I just know because I've been everywhere and nobody gets the same thing.
Right.
Nobody gets the same thing ever.
Yeah. Well, it's like... you know, we're all like waiting to be born and we're like ordering, you know, little bits of the, like this experience and this experience. And you're like, ah, shit, I'll take it all.
right.
And they're like, whoa, D, you know, there's like, no, just fill it up.
Yeah. Hey, and before I felt like a victim, I felt I was cursed. Why, God? Why? Why me? I just was born, yo. From the day I knew what I was, I knew I had a problem. Mm. You know what I'm saying? The day I understood who I was as a little boy, I knew I had a nipple on my knee and none of the other kids had nipples on their knees because they were pointed out and I didn't want to go to school. I'm talking about in nursery school, like when this type of trauma started. So what I'm saying that to say is that now what was once a curse from when I was ever, I'm talking about when I was first able to understand anything, was I felt I was cursed. And my curse has turned into a blessing in the sense that I believe that my God doesn't make mistakes. And if my God doesn't make mistakes, this was supposed to happen. And all of this happened to me because I'm the only one that can handle it with a smile, as my mother getting AIDS and HIV, but somehow standing in front of my high school for months with the megaphone, condoms, and HIV prevention literature. Like, what is in a person that's dying? No, they're dying. It's 1993. No, you're going to die because you have AIDS and everybody's dying. I mean, this is what's happening. But you're smiling and happy, like really happy, not fake happy, not pretend happy. Like, you're beaming. We're at church three times a week and you're living life like you don't know that you got months to live. That's my motto, though, you know, and no matter what happens or what I go through, I got to remember what I come from. And I come from that lady that did that. I haven't seen a woman on TV, in movies, in real life that have been handed a death sentence, own it, and then try to save everybody else. I haven't met these people yet. So I don't look at it as it's something that happened to me. This was, for some reason, me and her were born for everybody else. And I've just accepted it. I've been running from it my entire life. And now it's just... it's very enthusing, and it just makes my spirit lighten up because I know that all my pain, every day that I do touch five people, because I see them and we exchange information, and it's weird how it happens every single day. I know what I do in the world, and I believe that's why I'm still here. We haven't even got to the surgeries and the other part of the story, but I know that's why this is why I'm alive, to have cancer and tumors and to show people, yeah, it's messed up. But check this out. Everybody that didn't wake up last night, or everybody that didn't wake up this morning, rather, would willfully trade all of that, all of my pain, all of my tears, everything I've been through for one more day. I know it. I know everybody that didn't wake up this morning would willfully take everything that I thought I was going to complain about to spend one more time with their child, to see their mother smile one more time. Life is just too short. And I'm here to show people that through my story, using my story as the shiny object.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that when you said, from the day I knew who I knew I was a problem. Like, I heard the echo of, I think it was W.E.B. Du Bois,
yeah,
from like 1903 or something, yeah, in The Souls of Black Folks,
yeah,
used that phrase.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what does it feel like to be a problem? And I don't know why I'm bringing that up, except it touched me on this whole other level of, you know, the way you've shifted from like, I'm a problem to like, I'm a solution.
Yes. And that's what it is. And I believe that you got to show the bad before you could. A lot of people like to glamorize and glorify, you know, their arrival. Don't nobody care about your arrival. Okay. We care about how you got there. And that's the difference. You know, I share it all. And I believe I have to share it all to make the impact in people's lives. People don't want some perfect thing handed, like, look, you can be perfect too. That's not real. Not with the people I've interacted with. They want somebody that failed, that crashed, that burned, and got some masking tape and some Band-Aids and some Elmer's glue, and put themselves back together, because it humanizes me. Yeah. And that's what this is about.
Yeah. And also the fact that you say, you know, my mother and I, we were born for everybody else. And, no, you know, having met you and seeing, like, you're one of the most positive, happy people that I've ever met, it's kind of ironic that the minute you took on that sacrifice, that you were able to be happy.
It was hard. And don't get me wrong, I get upset like everybody else. The problem isn't with getting upset. The problem is staying stuck in it. That's what's wrong with us. Everybody, there's the people that pretend to not be upset are frauds because we're humans. It's part of human nature is emotion, and we don't have control over it. No matter how many meditation classes you do, there's somebody who has your number and your button. I don't care who you are, okay? Unless you were born in a petri dish, there is somebody that has your button too and your string and has the puppet thing for you too, you know? The thing is dealing with those emotions and then keeping it moving is when you hold on to it. I get pissed because I'm a human, okay? But I don't stay pissed. And people who stay pissed, I kind of move away from because it's contagious. You know, it rubs off.
All right, so I want to get back to the social workers and the people who finally reached you when you left the zombie war waving a white flag.
Yes.
because we're still really far away from the person you've become. I'd like to hear, you know, continue the narrative.
Yes. So from the zombie war, you know, met these, I don't know what we even call them, clinicians. They were like social workers in hospital style, counselors rather. And they just taught me some coping mechanisms. That's all. When you feel what you feel, D, your normal thing is to shut down or lash out. Now how about putting that energy on a piece of paper or a napkin, crumbling it up, and then flushing it down the toilet or burning it in the ashtray. And then when that's gone, it's up to you to go back to it. What's funny about that is when I met my teacher, he has a similar thing called catch and release, like a fish. You catch it, okay? You observe it. You do 3-second delay, and then you throw it back. And he kind of, one of his tools that he taught me is to use that when you become to get overwhelmed. And it's very much in line with what they taught me when I was hospitalized. It was write it down and burn it. And if you want to go back to that, that's up to you. But now in this moment, it's not there anymore. But again, got through that. Life was going well. I told you I started the business. But let me... I did skip how I got introduced to the weight. So after I got out of the hospital, I did a post program. It's not a halfway house, but they were like, D, being that you came in here, you tried to kill yourself. You're doing great. You're doing amazing. But we suggest that you do some aftercare living where counselors on site. At least do that for, you know, a couple months. I didn't want to do it, but these people had me feeling better than I have felt since my mom died. And I really didn't want to lose how I felt because I really have felt, I don't even know how to explain it. I wasn't me. I don't know who I was. But they had kind of, you know, got me into a different situation. I had a roommate that had just come home from prison and... This gentleman was very intimidating. He wasn't mean, but when he said something, he kind of felt like you had to do it. And we had 30 minutes for rec. And this actually started in the hospital, and he went to aftercare living with me. It was Serenity House. I was in Alexian Brothers, and then from Alexian Brothers, you go to Serenity House. And it actually started in the hospital, but had carried on. And because I'm with him, like, you know, and I'm intimidated. And he's an avid workout junkie and, you know, encouraged me to come downstairs with him. And I told him I don't really train. I'm not, you know, I'm a basketball player. We do push-ups and pull-ups and jump rope and things. And he's like, I need you to spot me. And he wasn't smiling. So I went down with him and I spotted him and this, you know, and we became training buddies. Really, I didn't have a choice, but that's what I called it. This is my training buddy, because I didn't really train. And then it turned in, I want you to try this. I don't lift weight. No, I really think you should try it. And then slowly but surely, before I knew it, he had introduced me to creatine, whey protein shakes, and that you beat the muscle up, you feed it, and it comes back bigger. That was his, those were his golden words. We beat the muscle up, we feed it, it comes back bigger. It's not astrophysics, D. We beat the muscle up, we feed it, it comes back bigger. So he had programmed that in my head. So now I'm a 157-pound guy naturally my entire life, maybe 160. That is on this calorie intaking muscle building mission. But Howard, I have to tell you, when I saw my first, when I my pec was able to move and I saw my first ab and my bicep, and I'm in the mirror and I'm like, okay, I can really gain weight. And I kind of got addicted. I was like, I can do this. And that's when D. Anthony Evans, you know, weight training career started in a rehabilitation facility that was saving my life because I tried to take it myself. That's the true story.
It's almost like your body had been producing these lumps that you didn't want and didn't like, and here was a chance to produce like the right kind of lumps.
Right kind of lumps. Right. Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. Yeah, but that's true. That's true. It's absolutely true. So, you know, really got heavily involved in powerlifting. But the powerlifting circuit that I was a part of wasn't the traditional powerlifting circuit. It was, you know, there's an underground and everything. And it, like, literally, there's an underground and everything. And the few... we call them bets. They'd be bets. They'd be powerlifting bets. And I got up to about 700 pounds on great days. And
700 pounds of what?
Deadlifting. That was my thing. Like pulling 700 pounds off the ground.
So deadlift is...
when you put...
The big bar is on the ground. It's got 300 pounds. It's a 50-pound bar. It's got 300 pounds on each end of it. And you just grab it with your hands and you lift it up to your waist or over your head?
You lift it up to your waist. So it's lower, promotes lower back and spine strength. And I could push 450 off my chest 15 times. I got up to 315 pounds. A 44 in the waist, and I was not a very happy guy, but I was happy with my strength. But as I'm drinking these powders and eating these large quantities of meat, my tumors did go crazy, though. You know, in reflection, they did. They were everywhere. But in my ignorance, I didn't attribute any of that to what I'm consuming. I knew it, I'm eating the nutritious thing to eat that promotes optimal health. That's what it said on the package. It said it promotes optimal health. And you can look like this guy on this package if you keep drinking this three times a day forever. And I was dumb and don't come from a muscle background, and I believed them. It's really as simple as that. And
these powders and the meats were promoting lots of things growing.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, when you do 10,000 calories a day, 40 pounds of chicken breast a month, and drink whey and casein shakes, you know, whenever you can get them down your throat. And don't get me wrong, I'm doing this and I am getting stronger. So in my mind, there is a benefit. But where I call myself out is, I noticed that my stomach was getting bigger too. I'm doing all this training and the cardio's not knocking off this pregnancy I have going too. You know, like it just wasn't, it was growing too. Like I'm getting bigger, but I have a huge stomach. And I didn't get it. And I didn't know who to ask. I hadn't talked to that guy. I don't know if that guy was still alive. They really taught me this. And I was big. I was big, so I looked like I couldn't ask anybody. It's probably an ego, though. Uh-huh. I'm like, I'm 315 pounds. What, I'm going to start asking advice now when I'm a monster? It was just, it was me, brother, is what I'm getting at. But that lifestyle, I can say with a clear conscience, contributed to what happened to me via the tumors and the cancer. I am convinced. I know for a fact the acidity created by that lifestyle of that old, that whole stomach was basically a gumbo pot of months and years of chicken and dairy. I mean, and you put dairy and chicken in something that can't breathe. I was trying to think of something that's big enough, a surgical glove, and it's going to blow up, a balloon. Eventually, the gas is going to blow up. Like, these are facts. I do demonstrations on them with meat and dairy and things that can't breathe. And guess what? That methane gas leaves one way or another.
Mm-hmm. So when you were doing your powerlifting, I don't know much about the life except that people who do it seriously very often compete in like really, really skimpy bathing suits.
They skimpy bathing suits and they don't get paid any money.
I mean, were you doing that while you had these lumps on your yeah. head and your body? Did you, was that weird? Because like, you know, for me, like looking at bodybuilding, it feels like there's a lot of, I don't want to say vanity, but just real.
No, it is. No, if you're asking me, did I have one of those leotards on? No. Uh-huh. No, I didn't have a unitard on. I did no. Uh-huh. No, I never did that. I'm the crazy dude that did it in fatigues and boots.
Okay.
And they always thought I was weird because I had to be weird, Howard. I wore winter clothes in the summer because for that reason, I didn't want anybody to see me. I wore a do-rag over my head and people thought I was trying to be tough or a thug. And really, I was trying to hide the tumors that were piercing through the hair that I had not cut since I was 16, because I've been hiding tumors since I was 16. Mm. But we had got to the point where none of my antics were working. Like you could see, and if I sat a certain way, they'd poke out my shirt. And to be honest, I felt like I was headed to death because I couldn't hide it anymore. So something had to give. I've been hiding this from everybody I know my entire life.
Yeah. So this is a personal question that you should feel free to ignore, but I'm wondering about, you know, your intimate relationships. Like if you're trying, yes. if you're trying to hide your body and your essence, did that get in the way? Was there?
And see, that's the thing. But, and I haven't been with a whole lot of women just because of that, you know, early on. Just like I still feel like people are grossed out by me. You know, my wife tells me, did nobody see it? You're fine. I want you to be a model. But in my head, Howard, I still feel like I infringe on people's sight sometimes. And my effort is to make tumors cool. And then sometimes I get looks, you know, from people that it does bother me. But I'm not really doing this for me anymore. Mm-hmm. That it would have been enough to stop, but I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it for everybody that used to think like I think, that won't come outside or won't go swimming. I got to continue to be strong through that. But yeah, always self-conscious, still self-conscious. I just love my tumors now. And loving them is the name of the game, but that doesn't mean everybody else has to. And I understand that too. Mm-hmm. So it's a little weird space I'm in. But hey, I'm owning Tumor Boy today.
Mm-hmm. And All right, so the cancers were the tumors were coming back. You'd had this message in your head ever since you were very young that you were prone to this cancer. Did you feel like okay, this is it now?
I did, and to be perfectly honest with you, I was when I took deep breaths, I could feel something pressing on my lungs. And I ignored that. That's something that should have you schedule a doctor's appointment. And I wouldn't. I wouldn't. The tumor that's depicted in all of the photos, I remember when I was taking deep breaths, lifting. After you do what I do with all that weight, you can. This is usually how you end up, and it's a lot of deep breath. And I could feel something back then. That's why I know when they say they think that it's been there for 4, 5, 6 years, that it's healthy, I believe them because I remember in 07, in 06, feeling something. I was at my biggest then. And I still ignored it. But it was January 2012, and was in Minneapolis, meeting with one of my very close friends that's a venture capitalist, and we were working on doing an old kind of branding an old project that I did. I did the Be Seen Being Green College tour that kind of promoted plants and sustainability. Go figure this, Howard. I did. This is how God and karma works. So in 2010, I did the biggest sustainability concert that the pop community had ever done. Nobody's really. This is when they were talking stuff about Solantra and whatever that company was. It just wasn't a time for green. Okay. But I had this wild idea that we could do a sustainability based concert because sustainability departments in every college get no love from anybody. Nobody even knows they exist. So I know that if I reached out to them with an idea, and some fancy names connected to it that's gonna bring light to what they do. They're gonna open up the city for me. It's just how my mind and my business acumen, how it
So
works.
this was a business thing for you, right? You weren't into
My intention was wrong, okay? This is all about money, but I know they weren't gonna put me in a position to make $300,000 to $400,000 a night if I'm not attached to something. I know where we're at as well. I needed a cause. I'm an entrepreneur. So I closed my eyes, and that's what I said. I'm gonna go with the green. Green is I smoke green and I'm gonna be green. No. And I got some family members. I'm not one that tries to do everything. Like I'm gonna get who's strong in the different suits, and we'll move as a team. And that's what I did. I can't say that I facilitated everything. I got my sister to do it, and then I got my brother-in-law to do some other things. But it's my idea. I got all the investors. I implemented everything, and they did the work. Like I was kind of CEO man. I bring people together that are strong in what they do, and then we move energy. That's just how I've always been. And in a nutshell, we sold out 4,000 seats at the James L. Knight Center in, you can Google it, in Miami. And we did the first Be Seen Being Green College Music Tour, partner with the University of Miami, the city of Coral Gables. Designated April 16th as Be Seen. We got Be Seen Being Green day. And then my partners embezzled the money, embezzled some money. Yeah, Howard. Via receipts and things. So we had an amazing turnout, had 18 cities, prospective cities we're looking at. To duplicate this 18 more times, and we didn't get out of Miami. before they start stealing. I mean, this is my family. That's why I'm telling the truth. All I got is the truth. And it broke my heart. And we cut the money up, and I just couldn't move forward with these people. So what I was in Minnesota for was rebranding it. Instead of the BC being Green College Tour, it turned into the GNMT, the Green Nation Music Tour. Would be the exact same thing, partnered with the same universities, and, you know, couple entertainment with education, making it edutainment. And we were bringing the high school kids in for free. We had a good system. And he was going to finance everything. So we were celebrating New Year's Eve. I didn't have a drink because at the beginning of the night, it felt like a cat was trying to tear. It's what, like someone was trying to crawl out of my back. It's weird. And, you know, I ignored it to the best of my ability. I don't even think we made it to the actual midnight. I think I was already laying down. Then, long story short, drove back from Minneapolis. I think it was the third or the fourth. And was in the University of Chicago shortly thereafter. And I was still trying to wait for it to go away, and it never went away. And I'm on my knees in that hospital, paging the doctor I hadn't talked to for 18 years, Howard. I hadn't talked to the man in 18 years. Paged him. He came downstairs. And this needed to happen because I had been holding on to this resentment, you know, for more than half of my life now. That this man is the reason why my life was crap is because he wasn't honest. And I had this surgery that I wouldn't have had and been able to play basketball. So I needed closure. And I said, I never talked to him. And every time I say I'm never going to do something, God kind of bam. And that's what he did. And I shared with him. I said, he's like, where have you been, D? I thought you were dead. I was like, well, Doc, I feel like I've been dead. And I feel like you lied to me. I've been angry at you. He's like, what are you talking about? I said, when I asked you the severity of my operation and would I be able to participate, you know, in the basketball program August 1st, and I explained to you what a big of a deal this is to me, and is there any way that I won't be able to play? And you kind of brushed it off, and I trusted you and believed you because I wouldn't have done the surgery had you told me there's a possibility that I might not have function in my knee. I just wouldn't have done it. He was like, oh, D. And he was sincerely, it was a heartfelt apology. And I wish you would have came to me earlier so we could have talked about this. We hugged, and he's not a guy that hugs. But we hugged, and this needed to happen. And then he proceeds to ask me what brought me in there. And says, let's go upstairs. We go upstairs, and I'm kind of telling him, as I'm walking through the door with him, and his nurses are kind of cracking jokes. You hear them smirking because I'm this 315-pound monster that's got a tear in his eye, and I'm complaining about back pain, and it doesn't look good to them. I look like a big baby is kind of how I felt that they were feeling based on their behavior. And I go in his office. I lay down on the table. And again, I'm 100 pounds heavier, muscle everywhere. And he begins to do the physical hand examination with his hand. And where I'm saying the tumor is at, it was there, but it was so much muscle there, he couldn't feel anything. And he's saying, D, I'm just telling you how the body works. If what you're describing is where it's where it should be, I should be able to feel it. And, you know, he continues to rub. And then I hear him not get frustrated, but I hear him, you know, not believing that anything is there. His voice, his tone just changed. And then he cuts into me about me, you're awfully big, D. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a power lifter. And then I made the mistake of telling him how much I lift on a regular basis. So that automatically becomes the problem. Well, of course your back is hurting. People that lift 600-700 pounds and push 450 out there, they have problems. D, this is normal. And he reaches for his prescription pad, and now you're going to give me muscle relaxers and pain relievers. And I kind of made it clear in my tone that, Doc, this is different. Like, I know my body. Something is not right. This is not muscle. This is something else. It's not from weights. He's like, D, trust me, you're not. And he's, again, like this surgery before, he's telling me, trust me. And I'm like, Doc, no, there's something in my back. And I didn't threaten him. I wasn't threatening, but I'm kind of made him know that I wasn't really leaving the hospital until we figured out something, because I don't think I have another day. Like, this is how bad the pain is. And not because he believed me, but to shut me up, he sent me down for slides. And I go down, and as I'm leaving out of the office, now the chuckles are louder. And Mr. Muscle Man's complaining, all those muscles, blah, 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 blah. And I walked out with my head down. I mean, what can I say to him? It didn't feel good, but I took it, went downstairs. Now, Howard, you know that radiologists generally don't release slides unless they do a report. It's just not protocol to release x-rays or MRIs or anything without some type of documentation attached to it. Mm-hmm. My slides, however, they beat me upstairs. Okay? And when I got upstairs, it went from laugh at D to the nurses are quiet, desolate, and looking at their feet. And the energy is just, I could just feel something's not right. And his door opens. And he won't look at me. I'm like, here we go. He said, D, come in, please. I walk through the door. He sits me down. And the slide that presents itself has a very, very significant mass on it. It looked like a gerbil or a mouse or a hamster or something that was sitting flush on my spine. And he began to tell me that he didn't think it was operable because NF tubers are connected to sheaths. And the sheaths on small tumors look like veins. And the sheaths on tumors my side are kind of consistent with an umbilical cord. And being that it had been in there so long, it had wrapped itself around some of my vital organs. And he was basically saying that, you know, the hospital doesn't generally do surgery because a patient wants them to do surgery. They do surgery based on success and reference. And there's nobody that has lived in a similar situation. So he was just telling me a worst case scenario. Like, you know, we don't really operate when it's this bad. Like, it's gone too far. Mm. He said, but look, I'm going to talk to my peers and to my boss and to my team. And give me 24 hours. I can't make you any promises, but I'm going to do what I can. Longest 24 hours of my life. And he calls and says, well, they're going to allow me to operate, allow us to do the surgery. I was happy. And how he explains it was like a episode of House when he's standing in the boardroom with all his peers in the hospital, board members and just all the elites in the hospital that make the decisions on surgeries. And he's saying that they're basically telling me that, you know, if something happens to this young man, that this is your career. because we're telling you, you're going to kill him. Like, we've saved nobody else that's been in a similar position. But just like House, he's always ends up being right. As crazy as his prognoses are, they work. They somehow work. He whatever he does, it works. And they allowed my doctor and his team to do the surgery. And they successfully removed a 2-pound, 7-centimeter mass flush off my spine. It was a 9-hour operation, but I made it through. And the biggest thing was signing the papers to say that I might be paralyzed. Like, I read everything. I don't even talk about that. It's the first interview I said that. But, you know, reading the words that we're not responsible if you suffer from paralysis, and me having to sign off on that, and then in my head, you know, just visualizing not walking, because somebody tells you that you might not be able to walk. I don't care who you are or how strong you are. That's going to resonate in your brain that after this surgery, my eyes open, my legs might not be able to move. But on the flip side of that, I also knew that nobody else was even in a position to get this surgery that has been in my position. So I was kind of scared and grateful at the same time. We waited 2 weeks for that pathology report to come back and celebrated, you know, like it was 1999, like Prince's song says. It was a great time. And that phone rang that Friday, and his nurse, Debbie, was like, D, we like to, and she was all chipper. She's like, okay, your pathology is back. I want you to come in. And came in, and I was happy, like, because I couldn't tell anything on the phone. But when I walked through the office doors, the same energy when I was walking in to get the slides, it was this. I said, come on, here we go. And sure enough, he sits me down and informs me that my tumor is positive for MPNST. That's malignant peripheral neurological sheath tumor. And just reminded me, even though I had all these facts, that, you know, post-operation life expectancy is generally 0 to 6 years. 6 years, meaning that it was atypia, which means it was precancerous and hadn't completely converted, or they caught it early. But 0, meaning it was 2 pounds and 7 centimeters. There's nobody on record that's had that much MPNST concentrated in their body and there be a recourse for that. And, you know, that did break me down, Howard. I gotta admit that, but like I told you earlier, it broke me down for a very small time because I was forced to tap into an energy that was greater than myself, and I tapped into my mother, you know? And like I told you earlier, while this woman was dying, she was in front of my high school with the megaphone, condoms, and HIV prevention literature. And I just knew she was turning over in her grave that I'm even thinking about quitting, thinking about giving up on life based on some statistics or what man said when before she died, I was in church 3 times a week. And I just, I could feel her. I'm like, get it together, D. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, look, Doc, I don't care what we have to do. Like, I'm not going to hospice. Because he encouraged me to meet with the hospice counselor, you know, and you know, a doctor's job is to tell you everything. And he told me everything that I probably wouldn't make it through June of that year. I need to get my affairs in order just in case. It just was stuff I don't want to hear, because unless you talk to God, like through text message or Facebook or a phone call, how do you know I'm going to die in June unless you kill me? I didn't verbalize that, but I wasn't ready to give up on life. And I told him, whatever we got to do, I'll sign whatever. But I got people counting on me, and I can't just get ready and prepare to die. Like, that's not an option. So I got what I asked for, Howard. I said, do anything you want and whatever you have to. And then that turned into 7 back-to-back 9-hour operations from January to November with over 225 tumors removed in that small amount of time.
And the imperative there was they all had to go to save your life.
Then, so being that nobody's really thrown $1 billion at NF or MPNST, because that's what it takes for 30 or 40 years of trials and studies. Nobody's done that. The general consensus when treating us, you ready for this, Howard?
Yeah.
Is to remove everything you see that's big, because everything lights up on a PET scan, and anything that was pre-existing that grew. So for me, I had 225 big ones that had to come out. I mean, because it is a fact that the bigger ones kind of convert. Like, they have a higher propensity to convert than smaller
to
ones.
To convert to... So
they're benign tumors that convert into malignant tumors.
Gotcha. So it's like whack-a-mole. The higher they come up, the more dangerous they are.
Exactly. Okay. Precisely. And so I had quite a few of the bigger ones. And man, from my head to my toe, Howard, they took those 225. Took one out of my thigh that was 2 pounds, but it wasn't malignant. And I'm just blessed to have been gone through this experience, and because it's taught me about the body and how resilient it. I know we hear this, but the body is absolutely amazing if you put the right things in it. Like, I heard people, the body will rebuild itself. I used to think those were just words, but I've had an experience, you know, that's really changed my outlook on that statement.
Yeah, so let's get to where you are now. You know, you have a teacher, you have a Buddhist practice. And we're not having this conversation because you're still guzzling whey and creatine and casein and chicken breasts, right?
So this is how the transformation or the transition transpired. I'm a lifetime fitness guy, and my teacher is a lifetime fitness guy as well. And when I got diagnosed, we had mutual friends and knew each other, but we didn't know each other. I knew of him and he knew of me, but we didn't know each other. And everybody's encouraged me, this guy could save you. But in the back of my head, I knew this was also the vegan guy, the plant guy. And I was still in meathead mode. And I said, man, the day I talk to this guy, I'm going to look like Carl Lewis. I'm going to lose everything. And this is what I was thinking about, Howard, instead of staying alive. I'm still in my prime, Nego. I'm thinking about how much weight I'm going to lose and how I'm going to look in the mirror, instead of, I need to listen to everything this guy says because he possibly can save my life. That's how sick I was, how sick we can be as men. I still want to worry about this. And I dodged him for a few months. He likes to say years, but it was a few months. And he found me in his cafe and tapped me on the shoulder. I was actually hiding from him because he was supposed to be at my gym and I was supposed to be at his, but he stayed at his gym because I think somebody told him, I think he's avoiding you. Hmm. And I'll never forget that day. He tapped me on the shoulder and he said, Mr. Evans, do you want my help? Because I'm not going to chase you. I don't chase people to help them. And I said, yes. And he said, write your address down and your phone number, and I'll be there Sunday with 21 plant-based meals. And the name of this gentleman is Master Vegan Chef David Choi, who is responsible for several Several high-profile individual chefs training that has in turn made a lot of famous people live the way they live today, notably Oprah. I'm not going to say what I usually say. The 1990s version of Oprah was Dave. Phil Jackson, the Zen master, was Dave influenced. Luke Longley, when he came to the Chicago Bulls, was a very big guy. Kind of got introduced to Dave. He had a 13-pack. We don't even know how that was possible for a center. And Dave founded the first vegan restaurant in Chicago. It's been there for 40 years. It's called Imitable. It is the first vegan restaurant. And what Master Vegan Chef David Choi teaches is that no matter what cancer you're fighting, the common denominator is the acidic environment that your pH is in. Bottom line. And what he reads from is a 3,000-year-old Buddhist medicinal scroll that's written in Mandarin. That really predates whatever we think we know. He's in his 70s and looks 30. His teacher's 109 and still drives around Chicago and runs the Buddhist temple. And the state can't take her license until she fails the vision, hearing, and driving test. And she hasn't failed. And this is why I listen to these people. But when I met him, he said, D, I can save you, but you're going to have to give up everything you love. I said, okay, Dave, what does that mean? Meat, dairy, yeast, and sugar. I kind of put my hand over my head like, that is everything, Dave. That's literally everything I get up in the morning for is meat, dairy, yeast, and sugar. They make me big and strong. He's like, it's poison. I said, why? He said, because the acidity created by that lifestyle and the fact that you as a lazy human being doesn't chew your food 70 times, you're being very naive to think that it moved through 30 feet of tubing from mouth to rectum. And I think about that. I said, what is he talking about? He's talking about my GI tract. He said, if you don't chew your food into a paste form, it's not just miraculously clumps of food just move through your GI. So it's not how this works. He said, and if the GI isn't cleaned out to the best of your ability daily, and he used FORD as the acronym, fix or repair daily. If you do not practice this daily, and program your body will program you. And I let that sit in. And he's like, I'm going to shed. And he started hitting me in the stomach. He said, you got abs, but they're under all this fat. And he's hitting me. And I'm really feeling like 3 feet tall. He says that about 6 to 8 weeks of fasting from meat, dairy, yeast, and sugar, your body will go into natural starving mode, sort of like a episode of Naked and Afraid. Those people go on there on that show, they're all gung-ho at their regular weight, and depending on them finding, being good hunters and finding food sources, those people dwindle. And if they don't find it, they usually get airlifted, because that's what starving to death does to you. It makes you go crazy. And what he taught me was that the same thing that happens to them, but they go into shock, because there's no like counterbalance. What he did with me is from week 1 to week 6, I have these meals that do taste like dirt because I'm used to meat, dairy, yeast, and sugar, but they were something. And instead of me falling right off the cliff, I kind of incrementally fell in slow motion instead of making a straight job. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's what we would now call like a fasting mimicking diet.
Exactly, exactly.
You get a lot of the benefits of the fasting, but you're not wasting away and your body isn't going into emergency mode.
Exactly, exactly. And what I watched my body do through the amazing bowel movements that I had that scare you, because you're like, I didn't even eat that much. Like, where did that come from? And then to just wrap my head around, you've been just walking around with old food in your gut. Like, that is something, like, when you really nail somebody down and have them really process that, like, you're walking around with old meat, old bread, and old milk, like, wondering why you feel bad. And when that clicked for me, it felt like the whole world shifted. Because now I'm trying to get the rest of the stuff out. Because now, And let me tell you, Howard, even though I'm seeing these results, I do what you're never supposed to do as a student. I say, why is the whey in the casein? I don't understand. A liquid. They move through your GI. And it kind of perturbed him. And he was like, look, I'm not going to argue with you. I'm not even going to debate this. At your next doctor's appointment, I want you to ask for the detailed pathology report and where the place and time where they can show you the protein markers and levels that fueled each tumor growth and pathology. That's how our technology is. And to see the words casein and whey attributed to my tumor protein, it kind of shook me up more than I've ever been shooken before, in the sense that it was verification that my lifestyle behavior, nobody else, me drinking powdered meat 3 times a day for 17 years is the reason I'm in the predicament I'm in. It was so eye-opening, Howard. It really woke me. I'm thinking, like, all this stuff that you've done for muscles, and you were slowly killing yourself, like literally killing myself. It's very powerful.
And that no one ever told you this, so that, you know, you had this congenital condition or condition from very, very young that I guess our society assumes progresses the way it did in you. And all of a sudden, you're like an N of one saying that it doesn't have to be this way.
Right, right. It doesn't have to be this way. But, and that's why I know this is my mission. It's just sharing this information and using my extreme story to keep and captivate your attention. I mean, because this information is not new, though. That's the disturbing thing. This is not astrophysics, Howard, and this isn't a new revelation, you know, but it's been so easy for society to ignore things. But we're at a point, you know, I resigned from my position in the American Cancer Society, but I served for 4 years as a lobbyist using my story as the shiny object to pass legislation in D.C. But in that journey, I've just been privy to some numbers that the rest of us aren't privy to. And the trajectory for colon rectal cancer in America is 75% of this country will have some form in 2020 by 2025. That is disturbing to me, and that's not that far away. We are in trouble. We're in a crisis. And I know part of me being here is that I made the decision. I did something totally outside of the box. I told my doctor and my oncologist to take a hike, and I started listening to the Buddhist monk. But that's what it is on the surface. At the end of the day, I got some information that I've personally seen impact and reverse lives, or reverse situations. Like, personally, it's been 6 years of this. I've come across hundreds and thousands of people in my 6 year journey that have implemented these things and had monumental success. But I'm not a doctor, and I can't really be out here saying all that specifically. I share information as a cancer patient. I share my journey and what helped me. That's about where I'm at and how I have to talk. But I know this is why I'm here, because we're dying and we're sick more than ever.
So what's your daily protocol now? I know you work out a lot more than the average person, and you credit that with keeping you going. Take us through like a day in your life now.
A typical day in the life of D'Anthony Evans is I have an amazing wife that kind of, she's a consultant, does her other business, but she's also taken me on as a business partner in the sense that all I have to do is train, get on my mentor calls, have surgeries, and speak. And she handles all the business, which has alleviated a lot of the emotional burden. So my days are dedicated to getting up at 3:30 in the morning, meditating, making some posts, clearing out my, I like to call it, clearing out my chest to make room for new junk, if you will. We collect junk every day, whether we like it or not. Then I'm at the gym from anywhere for 3 to 6 hours regularly. And then I'll come home, do a cannabis treatment to let my nerves ease. Because what people don't understand, when you have NF and you don't take their drugs, literally all day, because I walk on them, I sit on them. If I lay down, I lay on them. It's like just having needles. Like, wait, every time you get comfortable, something to make you move, which is cool. That's better than not being here. But I need at least an hour or two for my body to settle down. And then I'm ready to get after an interview like with you or do some camera work or whatever. But she kind of orchestrates whenever I'm booked around that type of schedule. When I met you, that it was the same thing. You didn't really see me. But when you didn't see me, I was either training or laying down doing, and that's the maintenance of this. I make it look very easy, but it's really not. Uh-huh. It's really work. It's work.
Yeah. What about the diet?
The diet will start with about a fistful of pine nuts. Can I get a container of pine nuts and bring them to the camera real quick?
Sure.
Would you like
sure.
that? Hold on 1 second.
That's a large container.
That's we agreed that's 3.5-4 pounds.
Yeah, that's like $100 worth of pine nuts.
Actually, these are $82 a pound. That's like $400 worth of pine nuts. But
okay.
but hear me out. Chemo is $200,000 a week. We have to have our priorities in order. But what this allows me to do is have the mass that I have and the strength that I have. Calorically, this is equivalent to 14 filet mignons minus the butt and the cheeks and the, you know, the other things you get from eating 14 filet mignons every day. And what he taught me is that, yeah, you hear about the body can only process so much protein, blah, 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 blah. And that's true. But when they're making these blanket statements, they're referring to one protein. Then that's not all protein. That's meat protein. Meat protein doesn't burn. Like it sits. It's fat. It burns like a candle. So, yeah, things sit with all that acidity in them. They're going to have adverse effects. My pine nuts, however, they burn like a firecracker. I'm going to be hungry after I eat all of this. It's still going to make me hungry and will be out of my body in the stool in no less than 8 hours every day for the last 6 years. Like, this ain't year one. This is year six. And as crazy as people, you know, like, you're going to eat nuts for the rest of your life. Yeah. I'm not going to change anything. Like, you don't get to your sixth year, start changing things when nobody else in your situation is here.
Right. And I just want to make sure that the people who are listening to this understand, because everyone wants a shortcut. And,
right.
You know, and I do too, right? So, like, the point here is not that D. Anthony says everybody should eat a fistful of pine nuts.
Right? No. Not at all. Right. Not at all. The point is that if you, you know, attain to be an optimal athlete with big muscles, the only way to gain weight or, you know, build your body it's through nuts, in my opinion, because I can only go off what I've used. It's just an alternate protein, and it's as simple as boiling them, blending them, and serving yourself, as opposed to buying dried, add water, and stir at the store. It's really no, most people buy convenience. This is kind of manual, but it's the same thing, just this is healthier. And I don't have a desire for everybody to eat pine nuts, but I do have a desire to teach people that if you continue to drink fake powdered meat that's unregulated by anybody and says it, some things are going to come visit you. And I'm not saying that to scare you. I'm saying that things that can sit on shelves for 3 and 4 years that you drink every day and think they leave your body in 8 hours, you're being very naive. That's all I want everybody to know.
And that the pine nuts you're eating are balanced with 3 to 6 hours of workout.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Because sumo wrestlers that he mentors too, they eat this too. And they, I mean, it does whatever you want it to do. That's an amazing point. If I eat that and sat around, I blow up. I would. It's no question.
Gotcha. So after the pine nuts, what else makes up your diet?
It's pine nuts, and then I'll snack on a gluten-free tortilla chip with my wife makes homemade hummus, and just we got several homemade tofu snacks and things that we do to just keep me busy. But my eating is about these nuts. Like, I don't eat for me. Like, that's not a part of my life anymore. Eating for tongue. I don't eat for tongue anymore. I eat for fuel. And this is him. This is his words. He says, you're never going to get over the meat and dairy if you don't let it go. Like, you're not eating for your tongue anymore. What has your tongue done for you ever? you know what I'm saying? Anything positive ever come from your tongue? You need to eat for your body, D. And that was hard. It was hard. It was the hardest, one of the hardest things I've ever done. But again, I was given 6 months to live in January 2012. We are almost halfway through 2018. I'm sorry. I'm reminiscing.
You got an extra year right there. So you now, I saw you at the Wellness Forum conference. You're involved with the plant-based community, and yet a lot of the plant-based ethos is kind of against what you're saying. Like, it's all about the plant-based tongue, right? Ooh, look how good, how delicious we can make this. How do you navigate that?
You know, everybody has their journey, and the people with the ethos and the plant-based can put their life next to mine. And then you see how you want to look and feel, and we all here for different reasons. I'm here so my body performs in line with that of the professional athletes that regular my advice. And I need to be the brand. So I can't be encouraging those $100 million people to do things, and then I'm not doing them myself. Like, they clearly get it because I'm just D. I'm not a doctor, but my phone's ringing.
So for folks who are listening who want to gain the benefit of your guidance and wisdom, what do you, I mean, do you have to be a 100 millionaire to work with you, or?
No. You know, to be perfectly honest, the majority of my time, and you've been on my thread, you've seen some of those success stories, is dedicated to the children and young adults. Not that we don't help adults, but a old hardened adult mind, you know, I'm not trying to convince anybody to do anything. I'm trying to help people who are in the red zone, preferably children who have only been here 16, 17, 18 years, if that, and show them that it's worth fighting for. My NF community, our suicide rate is in the 26th percentile for young adults and children, because nobody's ever sat with them at lunch. Nobody's ever dated you. It's a very lonely, lonely, lonely life being tumor person, okay? And these kids live in the time of Google. I didn't live in Google. era. Like, I couldn't be like this, and they tell me a million times of how bad I have it. These kids have access to Google. And if you read the first five pages of Google and what we have, and you're a kid with low self-esteem that nobody's ever dated, you've always been self-conscious about your tumors, and you've always felt alone, guess what? It's not worth it. It's not worth moving forward in a life full of what you've already experienced. And your parents don't know what to tell you, and your doctor has nothing to tell you because there's no research. They tell you to join a trial, and then you continue to investigate with your computer, and it gets worse. The information gets worse. Then you bump into me, and then I get an inbox. Man, D, I don't know how I came across you, but I was tired of living, but I came across one of your videos, and now I want to fight. Okay, that's really who I do this for. You know, I do it for my family. I do it for my children. I do it for my wife. But I do it for the person that has no more hope. Because earlier in this interview, I was the person with no hope. And I just want to be that person that shows them we have it messed up. But having it messed up is a lot better than not having anything at all. And I am you, I'm no different. And if you just hold on and be still in the storm, you can have exactly what I have, and I will help you. Most of my energy goes towards that. But everybody can get in tune with the movement. We have a nonprofit called Sheree Inspires. It was named after my mother. It should be up and running by June. But it will be geared toward making these kids that I'm speaking about feel special in the form of holistic retreats and things that they can do where it's secluded and they're with their family and they don't have to deal with the gawking eyes. When Make-A-Wish gives neurofibromatosis children wishes, to like Disney World or places with water slides, guess what? The kids still don't participate because they do not want anybody to see their tumors in a public setting. So the gesture was great, and Make-A-Wish meant well. But the child couldn't maximize the opportunity because he's still in public. So what we're in the process of doing is creating destinations that are more secluded, where we can fly the whole family to, and you guys can have your vacation in paradise by yourself. That'd be part of what we do with Sheree Inspires. It's just making these tumor children feel normal for a day if it has to be. Because I just know. I hear this till I got sick, Howard. People know me 30 years, never knew I was sick. I'm a childhood camp, like tumor patient, like that nobody knew. And I don't want any other kid to feel like that. This is why in my videos, I wear half of shirts, because I want everybody to see the tumors. Even if you don't like them, I know that a kid that sees me exposing my tumors, you know, I know who I'm communicating with when I do it. I know they're looking at me like, okay, he's showing his stuff. I don't have to really worry about showing my stuff. And that's a lot of what my mission is about. Coupled with the plant-based education, what the adult can get from me is seminars and workshops where we do teach you how to reverse, prevent, and manage disease through the plant-based lifestyle. You know, using my teachings through Dave and demonstrations and other things that I've implemented in my survivorship. And you can reach us at danthonytrains@gmail.com. And we often send what we call a starter kit. And it's just a plethora of information, documentaries, a copy of the China Study PDF. Because I feel like a person can't make this transition until they fully understand why they're doing it. You're going to fail. When your brain begins to work against you, because that's what it does when it doesn't get what it's been getting, you need help, you need assistance. And in a perfect world, I will have a resource component where you can call in and we give you help and all that. We're just not there yet, Howard. But my life, the rest of it has been dedicated to service before self and advocacy and awareness and sharing this message and how this information can help you help your family.
Right. And the extremes in your life make you so incredibly credible. Right? So someone listening to this is thinking, well, I had kind of a rough childhood. I says, well, D has me beat there. I've got some health challenges. Well, there's something about the extremes that you've experienced, yes, and that on the flip side you've chosen. I'm listening to you saying, well, I could never work out 3 to 6 hours a day. And as I think it, I go, well, that's not true.
Right. It's not true. It's not true. Ask me why I began to train like that.
Why did you begin to train like that?
Well, when the doctor looks you in your face and says, look, we'll probably be doing 1 to 3 operations until you die, because this is just the nature of where you're at. When you hear that you'll be having 1 to 3 surgeries every year until your possible death, it does something to your spirit. If you're any type of, I can't say a real person, but if you're a person that really has the fight, you should know you're gonna have to do your part, because the body is not designed for its heartbeat to be brought close to death, it be cut and then revived. Like just Faber, it's just gonna quit on you. So in my mind, I began, and this is my post today, and Dave encourages this, move from just being strong to an endurance athlete and tried to mimic what my body would go through rigor-wise during the course of a 9-hour operation. I haven't got up to train in 9 hours though, Howard. The 6 is the most. But the whole reason that I built this endurance up is so my body is in line with that of a professional athlete from my head to my toe when they're cutting me, so I can come back. And people thought I was crazy, but I've snapped back from every operation and trained in between every single one of them when I shouldn't have been able to.
So it's like your sport is 9-hour operations.
Yes, and that's why we call it training to live. Like, I don't work out. I train to live. When you work out, you can do that when you feel like it. You can take a day off. You can rest. My psyche is, if I don't train, I'm going to die. It's a very different mindset. But I feel like if you really care about your body like you say you care about it, nutrition, spirituality, and fitness, as my teacher taught me, should be firing perpetually at the same time to reach your optimal health. And I just got to thank David Choi again, because he taught me how to submit my pride and ego. I don't have a desire to be right. I know how to walk away. There's so many things that the old D did not have in his toolbox. He didn't know how to deal with emotion at all. And it's just been an invigorating experience to step outside of my old self and step into this new body.
How do you spell David Choi's last name?
C-H-O-I, Chef Dave on Facebook. And I'm not sure what the Instagram is, but it might be the same.
Okay.
But yeah, Chef David Choi. And then we have David Choi Jr. So Dave is actually retired. He still feeds me and the cancer people, but doesn't run the restaurant. Gave that to his brother. But his son, David Choi Jr., has kind of been giving the apron, in the sense that he's taken over all cooking responsibilities. He has an amazing health bar called Fighter, and that's in a majority of Whole Foods. And it's a phytonutrients bar that is housed in a refrigerator because it's real food. It's the only bar that I've seen that is refrigerated in Whole Foods, which means it's real food. And it tastes amazing. But So Dave and Choi Jr. has been given the responsibility of carrying on David Sr.'s plant-based medicinal recipes as the cook. His son Rocky just got back from Brisbane, has a double PhD, one of them in food science, that backs up all the words that come out of my mouth. And then you have me that's been given the microphone to spread the message. Rocky is to prove the message, and David is to cook the message. And that's that food heals. And what we put in our bodies either going to create disease or fight it. It's a real simple message. And together, we're just trying to keep the old man's legacy and the teachings going. And I'm just blessed and honored. Out of his two sons, he chose me to carry the microphone. I mean, it's not like I could have got the double PhD and cooked anyway, but it's just it's enlightening that you know, I've been given such an honor just knowing how much he's revered in the world. It's a great thing. The Dalai Lama, when he's in town, they stop at Amitabha. Amitabha is the Buddhist opening prayer by definition. Amitabha, that is the opening prayer of Buddhism. So it's just been an amazing ride, Howard. I'm just trying to help as many people as I can while I'm still here.
Well, you know, you've got at least two PhDs in life.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, I have one, and I've got to say the main muscle that it took was my butt just sort of sitting there for 6 years. So.
Well, that congratulations. You got it. You got it.
Your PhD in life, you know, you didn't necessarily know what you were studying for or why. But, you know, I think it's very clear to anyone who's listening now, like, regardless of what you think about, you know, fate or destiny or divinity or anything, that you've chosen, you've chosen an inevitable path for yourself.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I've been running from the path. You know, like, I know this is my purpose, and I feel stronger than ever because it's not a mystery. A lot of us don't know why we're here. You know, that's the big, why am I here? Why was I born? Like, I know I was born for no other reason than to go through all that I've gone through and then share it. Like, the complete opposite of what I desired. I was going to fight cancer in the closet. And the rumor mill had begun to brew so much in my community that people were calling my grandmother and my sister asking where to send funeral arrangement. We heard he's on his deathbed. And they're like, you got to say something. And I really didn't want to say anything. I hadn't told anybody I had tumors to begin with. And I just jump off the cliff like I have cancer. And I just didn't want, I just wanted to deal with it by myself. And in reflection, as I look at it, it's like that was my opportunity to either cower out and I know I'd be dead, or face it and embrace it. And if you go in my timeline to 2012, my first post, I addressed the peanut gallery. And I respectfully say, if you're waiting for me to die, you stay tuned. And I posted every day since then. Stitches, staples, the whole thing, just that allowed me to get out of my shell. The fact that people thought that I gave up. Now, I'm not a quitter. And it kind of fueled this public fishbowl persona that I was totally against. One more time, I've been hiding my body from the world my whole life until 2012. Like, this is a divine crossroad that God, like, shoved me out onto the stage. Like, you're going to perform or you're going to die. And I chose to perform. Like, threw me out on the stage. I didn't want to go out on the stage. But I'm here and the lights are on. What you going to do, D? And I stepped forward, Howard. and I step forward.
I'm just taking it in. I'm giving.
Let me choke you up. I'm crying too.
I'm giving my audience a chance to, you know, to hear it slowly and let it sink in.
I understand. I understand. This is my mission. And I appreciate you providing your platform to allow me get to a few more ears. I really do.
Well, it's a great honor. I hope people who listen to this will follow you, check you out. I hope the people who listen to this have even bigger stages and megaphones to allow you to do your thing.
Yes,
this is now the record. This is as of today, I've done, I think, 275 episodes, 260 are published.
Congratulations.
This is the longest one I've ever done. So,
congratulations. Thank you. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, we'll have to wait and hear from people, but I'm certain that it's a
good thing.
I mean, you know, the conversation goes until it doesn't. And with most people, we deal with the story, the prelude, and they get, you know, in a few minutes. And then we talk a lot about, right, your prelude was so, so rich and has something for everyone.
Thank you.
You know, you
Thank
say
you.
That everyone can relate to something. I was born on my father's birthday. So when you talked about your mother, I'm like, yeah, my birthdays are sad now and they're happy and they're confusing.
So, wow.
You've got enough of a backstory that everyone who has humanity can relate to it.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, man.
Oh, man. I appreciate it. I really do.
Yeah.
And I appreciate being on your show.
Well,
this is great.
Well, thanks. Thanks again. Now I'm not going to say I'm going to go work out for 3 hours, but I'm going to move my body.
There you go. I hope I had something to do with that. And on that project, I'm all in. Just tell me what we're doing.
Awesome.
I'm in.
All right. D. Anthony Adams, thank you so, so much for all you do and for generously giving us the time today.
Thank you for having me, Howard. I really appreciate it. Be well.
You too.
Thank you.
I hope the fact that you're still listening means that you were as changed, as touched, as inspired, as re-energized and refocused by this conversation as I was and am. Wow, huh? And I just spoke to D. Anthony today. I called him up because I needed a photo. I didn't have the photo that you'll see of me and him at the Wellness Forum Health Conference. And I called him around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I didn't realize that he's in Hawaii, and he just picked up right away and was chipper. And even though it was like 6 in the morning, he is already up and at 'em, and just a wonderful person to have in our corner, meaning the corner of those who promote life and wellness and justice and education and all the good things that need to spread in the world for the blessings of this planet to be distributed among all of us for the foreseeable future. All right, so if you enjoyed this episode of the Plant Yourself podcast and you would like to support the mission of the show, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. You can also share this and other episodes on social media, and you can become a patron at plantyourself.com. Just look on the right sidebar for the Patreon link with a monthly contribution. I'm over $500 a month, which allowed me to go to New York and buy a new H6 handy recorder. And I've already got a confirmation of a very exciting interview that I'm going to be doing live locally, so not over the phone or Skype. And I'll let you know more about that when it's in the can. So I don't... What are some vegan metaphors for not crying over spilled, kombucha, almond milk? You get the idea. All right, what else we got going on? The Big Change Program, as you know, is now part of WellStart Health. And again, if you go to wellstarthealth.com/program, you can just squeeze into this next cohort. If you want the show notes for today's episode with links so that you can actually get D'Anthony's starter guide, I have that link in there as well at plantyourself.com/270. If you're new to the show, catch up on 269 archived episodes over at plantyourself.com. I've got a new transcript from one of the interviews that I did a few months ago with Cyrus Kambada and Robbie Barbaro talking about defeating or mastering or living with type 1 diabetes on a plant-based diet. Thanks to Beth Hillman, that transcript is now up and available at plantyourself.com/258. In garden news, we're getting kale from the garden. Woohoo! And we got some blueberries that are about a week away from being ripe. It's been a crazy spring. Most things are way behind, but the blueberries look like they're a couple of weeks or even maybe a month ahead. So who knows what's going on. In running news, I did a good run this morning and yesterday, 7 miles each day, feeling pain-free. Again, if you want to learn how to do that and you want my secret guy in New York, drop me a line, hj@plantyourself.com, and I'll share those secret goodies. All right, thank you to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. Let's bring it up. You can find more of Will's music at willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself podcast patrons. Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Disson, Brittany Porter, Dominic Mara, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hathaway, Mary Jean Wheeler, Adam Callahan, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Burns, Christine Nielsen, Tina Sharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filkinowski, David Bisek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elizabeth Felton, Victoria Dolomanova, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Holly Peck, Michelle Enrich, Josina, Julian Rowland, Stu Dolnick, Sarah Durkis, Runs, Circus, Haley Cameron, Wayne Patterson, Leanne Peterson, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Benham, Gila Sert, David Don, Hugh Blair, Cyborg, Dorona Viazov, Gio and Carolyn, Arjitati, Jody Friesner, Ruth Ann Thunderberg, Misha Rosen, Michael Horbeck, Equally Mysterious, Tracy Lee, Alicia Lemus, Rebecca Hughes, Valen, and Rise with Cinnamon. Nick Harper, Stephanie Holmes, Martha Bergner, Nicole Ramsey, Susan Alon, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable, Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Sharp, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Ashley Corker, and Kelly Michia, Deanne Norton, Bonnie Lynch, Plan Happy Oregon, Samine Kurtzels, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Kobleshell, Ruthless, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Brian Sheridan, Shannon Hirschman, Kate Rosalind, Diot, Julie Langholm, Heather Gardy, Isa Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Aviva Lael, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Cherry Olakoski, Plant Power for Health, Scott Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Tanya Lewis, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Kelly Baker, Miracle Ann, Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelin, Valerie Peltier, Peter W. Evans, Colleen Harrison, Justine Divitt, and Joshua Sommermeyer for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for this episode. As always, be well, my friends.